They never kneel down, either, nor do they have a special pose for praying. The wise men of Tibet do not pray only on certain occasions. Their whole life is a prayer. The Lamas, on the other hand, have built up an elaborate system of meditation and prayer which they complicate more and more. Here is a list of some of the holy states of meditation practiced in the monasteries. Please note that this list of contemplations is not even complete. There are thousands of others. Contemplation having genuinely majestic and victorious characteristics. Progressive contemplation in pursuance to holy principles. Contemplation generously filling all the heavens. Indestructible meditation. Never perishing contemplation. Contemplation of absolute immobility. Inexhaustible meditation. Lightning contemplation. Joy-giving contemplation. Meditation which passes all objects of sensorial perception. Meditation which eliminates all doubts in a radical manner. Meditation which is past the effect of all joys and sorrows. Highly instructive meditation of the lion. Victorious meditation of the majestic moon. Contemplation creating radiant light. Meditation which does not look for anything. Contemplation without intellectual activity. Contemplation of immaculate brilliancy. Contemplation of immeasurable light. All illuminating contemplation. Meditation of majestic wisdom. Contemplation which leaves no possible choice. Meditation which never grows dim. Meditation transcending all forms of existence. Contemplation which has found a perceptible expression. Meditation of consciously desired immobility of the intellect. Meditation of definite liberation and non-attachment. Meditation which gives freedom from attachment to things mundane. Contemplation leading to detachment from things terrestrial, and so forth and so on. Doubtless enumeration of all these various forms of meditation, together with several hundred others not included in the above list, gives a Buddhist priest in Tibet the reputation of a very learned man. The Lamas obviously like to complicate matters. How different are the wise men of Tibet? They never complicate things. Real meditation, one of these holy men, who, by the way, never call themselves holy, told me, real meditation is a natural and effortless thing, not a fight to oust all thoughts which are conflicting with the specific thoughts one wants to dwell on at a specific time in order to get something in return for one's meditation, either materially or spiritually. He put it much simpler. But as these intimate spiritual contacts were more on spiritual planes than non-intellectual ones, I present these dialogues in a way which is more readily understood by the Western reader. The meditation of the Lamas, apart from very rare exceptions in the case of Lamas of the hermit type who can meditate truly, but do not need meditation at all, is of two different kinds. It is either no meditation, a mere posing and sitting motionless to acquire the reputation of holiness by pious dozing and napping, or it is the meditation of the fighting type so aptly described later in this book by my Tibetan hermit friend. The purpose of lamaistic meditation is to uplift man from the lower world of matter into the higher world of the spirit. It ultimately tends to separate spirit from matter, just as the ultra-materialistic attitude to life so common in the West tends to separate matter from spirit. Both attitudes, if I may say so with respect, are equally foolish. In so-called meditation, all ideas coming up during the course of meditation which are not in line with the holy thoughts desired by the meditating Lama are driven away by mental pictures which are antagonistic to the mental image desired by the Lama. The Tibetan hermits who had lived in monasteries at more or less remote periods of their lives were in a position to give me valuable information on the matter. The meditating Lama goes to a secluded spot, where such is available. If not, he merely isolates himself mentally, wherever he happens to be. He then assumes the holy position, taking great care that his spine should be quite erect in one line with his neck, and that the point of his nose should be just above his navel. Whenever he lacks concentration and feels that his thoughts begin to wander, he looks at his navel. Whenever he gets sleepy, he begins to look at the upper part of his nose. All thoughts which are not holy and happen to rise up during meditation must be ruthlessly fought by appropriate mental images. The most usual thoughts disturbing the peace of meditating lamas are said to be thoughts of lust. This seems natural. The sex life of the lamas is crippled in most cases, and desires which people do not dare to satisfy out of fear rather than out of deeper understanding have a tendency to leave the consciousness and to get a firm hold on the subconsciousness. When a lama starts meditation, he first makes his mind a blank. And whenever our mind is blank, the subconsciousness sets to work at once and all those hidden unwanted thoughts creep to the surface. When the meditating lama is thus assailed by sensual thoughts, he must fight those mental pictures by other thoughts producing disgust and horror of sensuality. The lama focuses all his attention on a certain part of his body and imagines that it becomes ulcerated. The more unpleasant the ulcer looks in the mind of the meditating lama and the more horror the deformity inspires, the better for the success of his profound religious exertions. Then the lama imagines that the ulcer spreads and finally covers all his body, emitting tremendous quantities of pus and blood. If this exercise is carried out in the right way, the lama must actually believe that his whole body is ulcerated. He must feel the pain and intense agony of his condition. It may happen that lamas are actually taken ill when indulging in such horrible mental pictures. In some cases, the disease may become serious. It has been brought about by sheer autosuggestion. After seeing his own body in an ulcerated and horrible state, the lama goes a step farther. He imagines the whole world peopled with numerous human beings and his horrible ulcer begins to eat into their bodies as well, until all human beings living in this world become an agonizing concourse of ulcerating and aching bodies. If the meditating lama has not become ill after all these horrible visions and still has the strength to go on with them, he begins to imagine that the ulcers are eating away the flesh of all human beings living in this world. These exercises are intended to help the meditating lama to get over the temptations of the flesh and to bring home to him the transient and unreal nature of the pleasures of the senses. They tend to fill the soul of the lama with such horror and disgust with all things mundane that he is bound to become more and more detached from matter and the temptations of the flesh. One of the meditation exercises of the lamas, however, is more beautiful. It sees the positive side of things and not the negative one. It tends to awaken love and sympathy. To fight callousness and lack of sympathy with suffering creatures, another type of meditation exercises is taught to the lamas. They are trained to imagine tens of thousands of highly sensitive beings, both men and animals, in the grip of the most horrible pangs. Their bodies writhe with agony and their pitiful cries of pain fill the universe. The lama must actually hear these cries of agony with his inner ear. These cries become more and more agonizing and swell into a deafening roar of agony. Then the meditating lama tries to evoke thoughts of sympathy with all those suffering creatures. He must do this so wholeheartedly that tears will come to his eyes. And then he will take, in thought, his tears into the palm of his left hand, bring it near to his heart, and throw them out in the direction of those suffering creatures. His tears will soothe their pain as if by a stroke of magic. But it is like pouring a few drops of water into a house on fire. The lama feels that enormous quantities of tears are required to quench the thirst of all those suffering creatures for a little pity and sympathy. So the meditating lama goes on crying and crying. Tears stream down his face while the vision becomes more intense. Finally, his tears rush forth like a streamlet. The streamlet swells into a river, and the river at last becomes as mighty as a flood going out to all those who are in agony. Although some of these meditation exercises are beautiful, they nevertheless tend to bring about results by outward practices. This is contrary to the ways of the real hermits of Tibet. The latter do not use any outward practices to fight the symptoms of human imperfection. The hermits go right to the cause. They work from within, whereas the meditating lama works from outside towards the inside. Quite unlike the lamas, the hermits do not separate matter and spirit. They try to spiritualize matter, whereas the meditating lamas tend to separate matter and spirit by detaching spirit from matter. Life should not be merely material. But life cannot be merely spiritual either. It must be both. Just as the ultra-materialistic conception of life, so widely current in the West, tends to detach matter from spirit, thus making life a poor and worthless thing. The meditation exercises of the East make the same mistake in the opposite direction. They tend to cause the meditating person to separate spirit from matter. If one carefully watches the lamas at times when they do not happen to be meditating to find out how they behave in the little things of their daily lives, one finds that they are no more humane than others. Their kindness and sympathy are only accorded on certain occasions. They are not continual, spontaneous, and effortless like the sweet and unofficious kindness of the real Tibetan hermits, who try to understand the full significance of matter and to spiritualize it by realizing its meaning. Only people who understand life, only people who have realized that life is both matter and spirit and who continually express this understanding in their daily lives are really human. Humaneness is the thing badly needed in this world, which dies from lack of love. We need people who are humane, really and spontaneously humane, in the little things of their daily lives. We have enough idealists who have occasional fits of idealism and tread the worm on the ground while they are looking for the stars. There is a story about a Western idealist whom his wife called to the sickbed of her father, asking him to attend to the patient's wishes. When she returned a few hours later, her father was dead and the idealist was seated in the sick room making plans for a big idealistic scheme to help the world, in which he, of course, was the central figure. While the idealist had been making his great plans, he had forgotten all about the dying man who had had nothing to drink and no one else to give him a little attention. The official medicine of the Tibetans is in the hands of the lamas. A large number of medicinal plants grow in the south of Tibet in the Himalayan region. They are occasionally used by the lamas for curative purposes, but in most cases the medical methods of the Tibetan doctor seem to be quite ridiculous to Western eyes. I saw lamas actually spit on wounds or sprinkle water into the faces of their patients, no matter what they happened to suffer from. Tibetan pharmacology works on principles entirely different from those of the analogous branch of Western science. What do you think of this Tibetan prescription? Take the kidneys from a domestic yak and dip them into blood. Then write with the blood the four holy words on the ground. After this, put the kidneys inside a little bag made of sheepskin, sewn up in the moonlight. Fill the bag with freshly collected dung and close it well. Then go round it seven times, turning your right side to the bag while you are moving. Then open the bag in a pious mood and take out the kidneys. They have now become a patent medicine against almost any disease. A learned Westerner may laugh at this, but it is a fact that 300 years ago the cure for rheumatism recognized by Western faculties of medicine was the administration of fat from human corpses. This method of curing rheumatism was considered infallible by the official medical science of the time. Not very long ago, bleeding was considered by Western science a remedy against many complaints. Today we have other infallible methods, such as vaccination and the like. But these infallible methods will give way to other infallibilities once the medical fashion changes. In the long run, our scientific methods are subject to fashion just as much as is the feminine sex. A Tibetan Lama preparing his infallible kidney medicine would just as much resent being laughed at as many folk in the West who take themselves very seriously, considering themselves to be strictly in line with the thoughts of their age and environment. I was greatly struck by the gross ignorance of the Tibetan Lamas regarding the most elementary anatomical facts. This seems strange in a country where cutting up human corpses after death is a widespread practice. Many a Lama, for instance, imagines that it is the kidneys which supply the seminal liquid and that the spine has a direct anatomical connection with the upper part of the chest. Unless the lamas intend these ideas to be taken symbolically, their ignorance must be appalling. Tibetan medicine very seldom takes the analytical viewpoint. It does not envisage the various parts of the body as being distinct from others, but deals with the whole body synthetically. The more learned type of Tibetan physiologist, as the hermits told me, speaks of invisible humors which pervade the human body and circulate in it. According to Tibetan scientists, an unbalanced state of those humors, mostly brought about by psychical reactions, or ghosts as the Tibetans put it, brings about disease, but they practically never look for a specific seat of the disease, and begin to treat the subtle invisible body rather than the gross physical body. On the whole, it would appear that the Tibetans are in the direction diametrically opposed to the cardinal sin of Western medicine, viz. Exaggerated specialization and localization. Our medical science, on the whole, does not take things synthetically enough, whereas the medical science of the Tibetans utterly disregards local seats of disease. Maybe the right course lies somewhere halfway between the two extremes. A Westerner trying to use a disinfectant, for example, would be laughed at by Tibetan scientists. The Tibetans say that epidemics are caused by bad thoughts and that good thoughts are a powerful disinfectant. In their turn, people in the West may laugh at this. But Western scientists themselves have ascertained that the water of certain rivers coming from the Himalayan region checks the development of all germs of disease, and many people whom the Tibetans credit with strong powers to emit good thoughts live precisely in that region. Chapter 6 Tibetan Miracles 7 The infallible medical methods of the professional healers are at the disposal of anyone who is willing to employ their services, which are, of course, rendered against payment in money or in kind. On the other hand, the wise men of Tibet never claim that their methods of curing disease are infallible. Nevertheless, they do possess methods of curing disease which are almost miraculous in their effects, but, contrary to the habits of the professional healers, these wise men never do anything for the purpose of gaining something, and absolutely refuse to put their marvelous methods of curing disease at the disposal of everybody. To Westernize this attitude seems to be rather callous, and one has to examine it very closely and with a very broad mind to find an explanation and excuse for it, but let me emphasize the fact that these men who so intensely feel the suffering of others do so in a spirit of sacrifice. I had my first experience with one of these wise healers. I had met them before, but had never previously seen them perform a healing operation, in the district of Tokt Jarlung. When a stone came down from the mountainside and would have most certainly killed a passing Tibetan had not a young man, with great presence of mind, pushed him aside at the last moment, saving his life. Unluckily, the rescuer was so much concerned with saving the stranger's life that in his generous impulse he had forgotten his own safety. A smaller stone which fell immediately after the big one tore savagely down his right arm from shoulder down to wrist, tearing away the skin and inflicting a deep flesh wound at least 20 inches in length. The poor chap suffered terrible pain as a result and lost so much blood that his clothes were soaked with it down to his knees before any of the bystanders had time to come to his assistance. No one had anything that could be used as a dressing, and I was just about to pull out the package of radioactive earth I carried in the breast pocket of my Tibetan clothes, intending to smear its contents over the wound and to make some primitive dressing afterwards by tearing up one of my pieces of clothing, when I was stopped by a Tibetan who had witnessed the accident. I immediately noticed the fact that he was scrupulously clean, a very strange phenomenon in Tibet, and his whole bearing was majestic, and yet humble, that strange mixture of conscious power and humility which characterizes all really great men. His face was not young, and yet it was practically without wrinkles. He had beautiful black eyes, and tears of sympathy were streaming down his cheeks. When he said, "Stop, let me do it," it sounded like a mild entreaty, but the sound of his crystalline voice seemed to go right to the heart. He went up to this youngster writhing in his agony. He gently touched his hair and cheeks. The blood now streamed down the helper's clothes, but he did not seem to mind this. With infinite tenderness, he caressed the young man's head. The pain must have disappeared as if by a stroke of magic wand. The boy, who had been moaning with pain a few seconds before, looked up and smiled. Then the other seized his arm and made some passes over it. I am unable to say whether he actually touched the bleeding wound or whether his hand passed over it about an inch from it. Be that as it may, the bleeding stopped instantly. 1. Then the helper tore away a piece from his clean garb which, contrary to the clothes of the other Tibetans, seemed to consist of one single piece of cloth. He made a dressing over the wound. The young man continued to smile. All pain had disappeared as if by magic. "Now, my dear boy," said the man with the brilliant eyes, "go. If you have good thoughts, and I do not doubt you will have them, you good, kind-hearted creature, your wound will heal in a few days." "Thank you," stammered the youngster.
"Don't thank me," returned the helper. "Thank yourself. Love has cured you. You have given love, and love has helped you. Live in such a way that I shall never regret having helped you."
Gale-pip, these words, uttered with infinite kindness and love, were also a command. Tears of emotion and gratitude streamed down the face of the youngster as he went on his way. Strange to say, the Tibetans often show tears of joy and pity, but they seldom show tears of pain or express sadness and mental anguish. The other Tibetans had not uttered a word. They hardly dared to look at the holy man, and when he said goodbye to them they moved, trembling and awe-stricken, out of his presence.
"Goodbye. I was the only one who remained on the scene of this almost miraculous healing." He came a little nearer, his beautiful eyes sparkled. "When I looked into them I forgot the past and the future and became intensely conscious of the present. I should make a good doctor, should I not?" he asked smilingly.
"How strange." He exactly expressed the thought that had crossed my mind a few seconds before.
"Yes," I replied. What was the use of posing as a deaf and dumb person in the presence of someone who could read other people's thoughts? "And yet I cure people only in quite exceptional cases," he went on. "Of what use would it be, for instance, if I cured a person who had been taken ill as a result of continual overeating? By the way, people do not overeat themselves in Tibet so often as they do in the West." He gave me a significant glance. I could not help starting slightly.
"Don't get uneasy," he said, "I shall never give you away. People of my type are not likely to betray anyone." I felt quite reassured.
"Well," he went on, "I should cure a person taken ill by overeating only in case I felt that he would not begin overeating as soon as he was cured. There are people who would use the help given in such a manner as to become still more harmful to others and still more cruel to their own poor bodies. But," he added, "there are exceptions. I myself have just healed someone."
"You saw it. You helped the youngster," I said. "Would you have helped the man who had been rescued by him?"
"Don't think I am brutal, friend, when I tell you that I should not have helped him."
"Do you mean that?"
"I always mean what I say."
"Isn't that a harsh and unkind attitude?"
"It seems to be if you view things superficially, but in reality it is not. All misfortune that befalls us is of our own making, the result of evil thoughts and evil actions. We reap what we sow. The man for whom the stone was destined was rescued this time, but sooner or later he will be in the same situation. If not in this life, then in some future life." How well I understood this man. Sometimes I did not catch the meaning of more than three or four words in a whole sentence, and yet I understood all that he was saying. "Shall we not fight evil? Shall we not fight war, for instance?" I asked him.
"War is the outcome of evil thoughts, of man's selfishness," he replied. "Many people are warlike at heart. They fight those around them continually in various ways, and at the same time they talk of peace. If people are against war because they are afraid of war, their resistance is of no value. Don't let us fight symptoms, but let us change our hearts." I realized how little chance such a man would have of being understood by most people, in no matter what country. The kindness of the wise men of Tibet is a kindness of strength. It is impersonal in the widest sense, far-sighted and just, whereas the kindness of the other Tibetans, including all so many priests, pilgrims, and so-called idealists, is a kindness born of weakness. It is essentially short-sighted and self-centered and on the whole disastrous in its effects, because it merely covers up symptoms, thus making people forget all about the inherently rotten state of affairs, due to a wrong conception of life, which has produced those symptoms. Compared with the total population of Tibet, which probably amounts to a couple of millions, the number of these wise Tibetans is exceedingly small. It is certainly much lower than 1,000.
They are greatly respected by the population, although they never make the slightest effort to become popular. The opinion of other people is quite a negligible matter to the wise men of Tibet, whereas the whole meaningless lives of other Tibetans bear the stamp of other people's opinions. The popularity of the wise men of Tibet is enormous. The very fact of being granted the privilege to talk with them confers a certain distinction in the eyes of the Tibetan masses. As some Tibetans had seen me in conversation with the holy man after curing the youngster, this was likely to give me so much prestige and make me the object of so much attention in the district that the wise man, who, of course, knew that I was a Westerner, advised me to leave the district as quickly as possible, and helped me in every possible way to accomplish this. However, before parting with him, I asked him, "Do you think you are great?" He smiled. "Nothing is high and nothing is low, my friend," he replied. "The insect is just as important as a small man or a so-called great man. There is just as much turmoil in a kettle of water which is boiling up as in the creation and downfall of an empire or the creation or destruction of a universe. All is relative. There is merely the passing and the eternal. What will be left of the bones of the greatest men in 6,000 years' time? Not even their memory may survive. All is relative, my friend. I am not greater than the bird in the sky or the worm in the ground. Only life goes on. The form is immaterial. These men do not want to be respected, and yet they are respected. They are like children at heart, that is to say childlike and simple. They seem to avoid the most dreadful pitfall in the way of a person rising spiritually, namely spiritual arrogance. They are humble servants of humanity without any claim to spiritual rank or distinctions, be they ever so subtle. There are Tibetans who take advantage of the great prestige of the real hermits of Tibet by making an effort to give themselves an outward appearance that is similar, posing as real hermits. Even the lamas often find it useful to pose as hermits in order to heighten their authority. They will retire into solitude for several years and become hermits outside the monasteries for the purpose of becoming more respected and gaining promotion to the higher ranks of the Tibetan priesthood. The careful observer does very well to keep the two types distinct. There is an enormous difference between the real Tibetan hermit and those who merely pose as hermits for selfish purposes. On the whole, the real hermits are far more inaccessible than the hermits of the other kind. They appear only when they positively know that it is of some use to show themselves either, in rare cases, for teaching or to help somebody. Travelers may visit the most inaccessible parts of Tibet where the hermits really live. They may get to places only a few hundred yards distant from their humble abodes, and yet they will never meet them if the hermits do not wish to show themselves. The real hermits are never out to satisfy people's curiosity. They sometimes give information, but when they do so, they always have some constructive purpose in view. Practically all the so-called hermits of Tibet, who live in small cells hewn in the rock, and who often spend many years in utter darkness, are not genuine hermits. Everyday food is brought to these pseudo-hermits and they never see the person bringing it, so that their isolation is complete. It is not necessary for the real hermits to follow any of these outward practices, such as dark cells, to be able to concentrate. If they go into seclusion, it is merely for the purpose of avoiding coming into contact with the curious. However, not all people of the genuine hermit type appear in the visible form of hermits. Some of them do not live in seclusion at all and look so like ordinary human beings that they can only be recognized as hermits by other hermits. There is really no outward sign by which such people can be recognized. It is a curious fact that occasionally, when he feels the need for doing so, a really wise hermit of Tibet may intentionally adopt filthy habits. He may do it, for instance, for the purpose of curing people of their worship of the visible form of great men. A small number of people of the genuine hermit type even live inside the Tibetan monasteries as lamas. Lamas who have turned religion into business, or who are spiritual because they expect some subtle reward for being spiritual, will never realize the real nature of the other type and mission. It is probable that the lama who saved me in the monastery belonged to this category. The real hermits never make people intentionally afraid, neither do they try to make them believe in their powers, but the false hermits do both. Genuine hermits have nothing to give and nothing to promise.